This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome to the third episode of a series from Urban Political Podcast in collaboration with the Georg Simmel Center for Urban Studies at Humboldt University Berlin. This series features speakers from the center's Think and Drink Colloquium. The colloquium brings together international scholars from across urban studies to present their work and fosters an informal space for exchange between students, faculty, and the wider public. In this episode, we are pleased to feature Hannah Baumann, a researcher at University College London's Institute for Global Prosperity within the Bartlett Faculty of the Built Environment. Her work explores how infrastructures shape urban exclusion and participation, particularly for refugees and migrants. She frequently employs participatory, creative, and arts-based research methods and serves as an editor of the journal City. Beyond academia, she advises policy organizations and local governments on participatory planning and has worked on human rights and urban development for NGOs and UN agencies. Her talk, Infrastructures of Urban Citizenship, examines how public services shape belonging and participation in cities. Drawing on research with migrants and refugees in the UK, Lebanon, Germany, and Jerusalem, she explores how access to urban infrastructures, particularly food and waste systems, becomes a site for negotiation rights and crafting new forms of local belonging. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode.
The talk today focuses on the role of public services in shaping the boundaries of belonging and the possibilities of participation in cities. And I want to start with a warning. I'm trying something a bit new. It's a work in progress. I'm trying to think across projects of the last 5+ years across 4 different sites in one talk. So I'm just trying this out. Happy to sort of get feedback and use this as a starting point for discussions. The projects that I'll be talking about are working with non-citizens, specifically refugees in 4 different cities in Israel, Palestine, in Germany, in Lebanon, and in the UK. Using ethnographic, participatory, and design research. And I've looked at a range of infrastructures in my work, specifically mobility infrastructures, but today I'm going to focus on infrastructures around waste and using surplus food, so food waste, for food systems as well. The aim is really to try to begin to develop a topology of different articulations of what I'm trying to call infrastructural urban citizenship across these different sites. Maybe a few starting points, the different fields and literatures that I engage with are critical citizenship studies, the idea that citizenship is not just a legal status that's conferred on people, but also something that's enacted through confrontation sometimes, but through everyday life. And in this field, what's less talked about is the way that it's also enacted through the materiality of the city. Secondly, in anthropology and geography in particular, there's been a lot of work recently on infrastructural citizenship, which shows that service provision is an arena of contestation where citizens take an active role in shaping their relationship with the state. And these are primarily sort of deep ethnographic studies among marginal national citizens in very unequal cities in the global south. So, for example, India, South Africa, and Brazil feature very heavily in all of these studies. Fourth is the literature on urban citizenship, where there's this idea that localized forms of belonging promise a more kind of cosmopolitan democracy, especially as cities become more independent actors. So, for example, local voting rights or the cities of sanctuary movements where cities sort of stand in opposition to nation state laws. And finally, in migration studies, the infrastructural turn has also done its work and is mainly reflected in ideas about social networks and spaces and platforms that either enable mobility to a new place or facilitate migrant integration. This work on arrival infrastructures is less about what urbanists would talk about as hard infrastructures. So the pipes, the roads, the wires that enable circulations in the city, and more about social infrastructures usually. So I try to build on these insights to ask how infrastructure interacts with forced displacement, across global North and global South contexts. So I'm trying to examine how the state and non-citizens, so people who are excluded from formal de jure rights of citizenship, negotiate access to the city's circulations and public services, and what this tells us about local forms of citizenship. And I'm going to try to deploy a relational comparative approach, so building an argument across four very different sites, which I think is useful for looking at translocal processes like migration. So in my case, I'm looking at the migrations of Syrians, of Palestinians, but also of Palestinians from Syria. So you already see that there's a lot of sort of connections between these different places, but also developments like the privatization of public services that are quite common in cities around the world. I think it's quite important to incorporate Southern urban theory when we theorize cities of the global North, especially as these come to be shaped by people from the global South who bring their own knowledges and expectations with them. And the aim, as Jenny Robinson writes about in her work on urban comparison, is really advancing an understanding of shared processes without trying, as she writes, trying to control for difference. Yeah, not trying to be like, we have to equalize each case study, but instead think with the shared features and try to mobilize that difference to interrogate the different conceptualizations. The structure of the case studies that I really just briefly sketch for 5 minutes each in this talk will go through Jerusalem, where an from the top down infrastructure is used to draw borders in the city, and residents use protest to gain access to infrastructural services. Then we'll talk about Berlin, where infrastructural services are used to shape subjects and subjectivities, and residents adopt new infrastructural norms. In Lebanon, I'll talk about a collaborative design project that took place in Bar Elias, which is a city in the Bekaa Valley in the east of Lebanon, where the state is really marked by its absence in terms of infrastructural care. But displaced people, migrants, and refugees step in and take care of the public realm and maintain urban systems where the state isn't there. And finally, the last case studies in London, where privatization and sort of outsourcing a lot of social care to the charity sector is the background setting, and work with migrants and refugees was around visioning and provisioning universal basic services. And I'll go into what I mean by that later. So after I spend a couple of minutes on each of these, I'll try to draw them together and offer some joint reflections across these sites. So we begin in Jerusalem, where I did my doctoral research as well. At the time, I was writing about mobility infrastructures and how they function to exclude but also incorporate residents of East Jerusalem, so Palestinian residents of the city, through the movements that they can make in the city. The background here is that the city is sort of bifurcated by many borders, and they overlap in various ways. So we have the armistice line of 1949. So everything that's to the west of that is considered Israel proper. Everything that's to the east of that is considered occupied Palestinian territory under international law. But then you have the municipal area of Jerusalem, which is what the state of Israel considers all of Jerusalem. So East Jerusalem, which is considered occupied under international law, is under Israeli law considered part of Israel. So there already you have the sort of gray zone in East Jerusalem where there's the debate about where this area belongs. And on top of that, you have the separation wall that Israel built in the last 20 or so years, which doesn't quite follow the outline of the municipal border. In fact, there's these two areas marked in red, which are inside the municipal boundary, but outside the wall. And these are the areas that I'm looking at that are quite interesting because they're in this gray space. On top of this kind of contested nature of space, you also have a difference between the territory and the people in East Jerusalem. While Israel annexed the territory of East Jerusalem, the residents, Palestinian residents, don't have citizenship. So most of them are stateless. They have a Jordanian ID, but not citizenship. And in fact, in Shafat refugee camp, which is the only refugee camp in Jerusalem, in the Jerusalem municipality, they're also refugees. In terms of their relationship to the municipality, they generally boycott municipal elections in a sort of refusal of accepting or recognizing Israeli rule over East Jerusalem. But they still engage with municipal offices, they pay municipal taxes, and so on. I've argued in previous work that in the situation where intra-urban borders are really contested and Palestinians' legal status is very precarious, they can easily lose their right to residency in the city. Public services are involved in kind of contesting and drawing the boundaries of citizenship here. So in this area of Shofaj, in this refugee camp, de jure, under Israeli law, this is part of the city, but de facto, this area doesn't receive any services. So there's often an absence of running water, and what I've focused on is waste removal. And beyond the kind of health and psychological impact that has living in mountains of waste, this exclusion from the city's sanitary circulations already also operates on a political register. So residents have reported that they feel really alienated from the city. They don't feel part of the city. They try to leave. They think that leaving the city or moving abroad altogether is their only option. And media and political discourses also kind of utilize the absence of services in what I would see as a kind of self-fulfilling stigma. So when an area doesn't receive any services, it's sort of affiliated with lawlessness. It's seen as unsalvageable. And there's been political proposals to excise this area, so cut it out of the territory of the city, and for people who live there to lose their residency rights as well. So there's a kind of self-perpetuating element here to that stigma. So I read infrastructural disconnect as a form of symbolic expulsion and argue that the boundaries of the city and of urban citizenship are de facto redrawn through infrastructures here. In terms of the responses of local residents, what's quite interesting is that despite their refusal to accept the Israeli mayor and government over East Jerusalem, they actually appeal directly to the mayor, the previous mayor, Neil Barakat, in this case, in a call for a protest because of this waste crisis. So they write in this call, "Stop avoiding your responsibilities towards the residents of East Jerusalem. Act to regularize and resolve the efficient disposal of garbage from Shofaj refugee camp." And they compare themselves to residents of West Jerusalem, so the Jewish parts of the city. And they say the funds allocated to garbage disposal per resident of the camp is only 1/5 of those appropriated per citizen in West Jerusalem. So there's a distinction made between resident and citizen, but there's also the sense that both sides pay equal amounts of taxes and should receive equal services. So what we see here is a kind of act of citizenship, this kind of demand, this protest, without what Eisen and Nielsen call the practices of citizenship, which involve voting and kind of these formal ways of engaging with states. And second case study is here in Berlin, where infrastructural citizenship is not just a sort of a contrarian or a protest movement necessarily. Over 1 million Syrian refugees arrived in Germany over the past 10 years. In 2022, I conducted interviews with 20 of them. These were people who had refugee status and lived either in shared accommodation or in their own flats in different parts of Berlin. Environmental awareness raising was really a key aspect of a lot of integration and language programs. There's a lot of funding that went into educating new arrivals about the meaning of the environment in Germany. And even before many of the respondents left emergency shelters, these Syrian refugees were instructed in proper recycling methods. So they received information with their asylum papers and in guidebooks about how to sort their waste properly. In their integration language classes, they learned about recycling, and some of the early oral exams are also about sort of reciting the rules of recycling. What was interesting to me is that the respondents learned about this process multiple times, but it really sort of changed their attitudes towards the environment. Many internalized new views around the environment, internalized the recycling rules, and also enforced them on others. And so I'll read a few quotes from the interviewees here. So Abir said, "I got really upset when my roommate doesn't follow the recycling rules. I tried to send them the website and the links so they can read it all and do it as well. I don't think it's enough to only separate the garbage. It's not enough anymore. I'm just trying to open the eyes for the people who are coming from my culture," referring to Arab and Kurdish culture, "just to teach them that this requires something coming from us. If you're not helping the environment, you have to do something." So there are several respondents who spoke about an increased appreciation of the environment, including for their mental health, something that they felt they learned in Germany, that their eyes had been opened to, that they weren't really aware of before. And they also saw recycling as part of their responsibility as an active citizen. So Abir, for example, then talks about giving back to the country that hosts her and this kind of being active and promoting environmentalism as part of that. Zainab said, "In the building that she lives in, the other residents never abide by the recycling rules. We tried to print flyers and we talked to the neighbors. We said to them, how about we clean the stairs every week, for example? You can do it once and we can do it once instead of having it having to get awfully dirty. How about we take turns cleaning the stairs? Let's try to have everyone not dump their household furniture in the Hof, she says in German, because it's forbidden. If you see someone who does this, tell us so we can talk with the building administration. We tried. We took the initiative because they were foreigners, she says. She herself is from Syria. So multiple respondents talked about this lack of awareness of waste management among foreigners, and several saw it as their responsibility to teach newer arrivals or less integrated people about recycling in this manner, which I thought was quite interesting. And then finally, Nabil, he sort of reflects in a funny way. He said he was previously in Freiburg and then came to Berlin. And he said he noticed that recycling is less thorough in Berlin than elsewhere in Germany. I noticed it, and I'm not even German. So what if I were a German coming from Munich, God forbid? I came and I got in the mood of Integration and Assimilation, he says in German and laughs. And now I separate the waste even more than the Germans, but I happily do it. Now at this point, I feel happy when I see the paper waste separated. So I think this kind of internalization of the rules, it even has a kind of affective impact, is seen here as a sign of really becoming German. It's not just, you're not just going through the motions and doing the things you're supposed to do, but you're really beginning to embody it as well. There's a kind of dual capacity for infrastructures to both exclude and incorporate people into the urban citizen sphere. And I theorize them as a kind of nexus between the urban public and the sphere of governmentality and the very private realm, where it becomes quite personal as well. And I think you can see that through these different kind of scales that I've been talking at. So we can talk about kind of spatial planning and population management, but also the way that infrastructures, because they're so present in your everyday, can instill values or enforce certain conduct as well. A third site is in Lebanon, where I was part of a year-long participatory research and infrastructural design project in this town of Bahr Elias, which received a lot of Syrian refugees because it's located very close to the Syrian border, and really moved from a town to becoming a city and kind of learned to become a city through the presence of refugees as well. The background in Lebanon is that since the end of the civil war in 1990, infrastructural crisis has been rampant. Really, the public systems were never fully rebuilt after the civil war. And you have privatized provision in order to have drinkable water, in order to have power and so on. You need to sort of supplement the public system with private systems all the time. And because it's a highly sectarian society, sectarian patronage is tied up with the way that infrastructures are distributed as well. In terms of Syrian refugees who live in camps, these camps never became formal, but a large portion of the Syrian refugee population lived in these camps, and they were never connected to the public network, as small and dysfunctional as it was. And that had the sort of background that Lebanon had this experience of Palestinian refugees, which the current government or state sees as having destabilized the state. They didn't want Syrian refugees to settle permanently. And so they never wanted to make those connections to the camps. I think on the one hand, because there's a symbolic element to when you're connected to the national network to sort of become part of that polity, but also because of the obduracy of infrastructure and that once something is built, it's very hard to sort of roll it back. And if people are living in shacks or in tents, even 10 years into a crisis, they're more likely to leave, as inhumane as that might be. In that situation, at the same time, while being really disconnected from the public networks, Syrian refugees also served as an essential sort of service provider within these cities. And Mona Fawaz and colleagues have talked about refugees as city makers in Lebanon, not just because they are delivery drivers, cleaners, and so on, but in Beirut in particular after the war, because they rebuilt the city. And I'm talking about the civil war, of course. So I'm put here this still from a film by a director called Ziad Kathung called The Taste of Cement. In this film, it follows these construction workers from Syria who are building the new skyline of Beirut, these glitzy, very tall towers. But they're not part of the city. They look out at the city, but they never leave the construction site. They sleep on the construction site. It keeps them sort of closed in. And so a lot of that kind of maintenance work of infrastructural networks that refugees do and migrants do around the world is, of course, in sort of invisible labor, working in the waste sector, working in the construction sector, working in as delivery drivers and so on. It's quite interesting about our project in Barlias is that there was a certain amount of visibility that came with those projects. So there was sort of a joint research phase where Syrian and Palestinian refugees and Lebanese citizens worked together to research infrastructural issues in the city and then designed proposals of how to address them. And a range of infrastructural improvements were made to the main road of the town, as well as a small park that was built in the center of Barlias. 2 years later, we went back and did an evaluation, and that really showed that these newly established spaces increased intergroup contact in a town that was marked by a lot of intergroup tensions because there was such a high proportion of refugees to locals. And especially the Syrian refugees who were living in camps, in small tents and so on, welcomed the ability to use public space more, which shows that those people who are often not considered in the design of infrastructures are those that rely on public services more than others, really. And in this work, for me, maintenance emerged as a really central theme. The municipality, especially after 2019, where there were a range of crises in Lebanon, really couldn't maintain the public realm anymore. So, for example, manhole covers would be stolen for the metal and the municipality wouldn't replace them. There would just be a hole in the ground. The park that our project had built, there had been an agreement. The municipality would continue to water the trees. They didn't do that. Waste wasn't removed. So things fell into disrepair, not just with the project, but the sort of municipality overall. And here it was interesting that the local citizen scientists that we worked with, in particular, some of the Syrian and Palestinian refugees, stepped in to this kind of void, negotiated with the municipality and local politicians about maintaining the improvements. They stored parts of the interventions. For example, we had installed some speed bumps that had come loose and they stored them at their homes to install them later. They coordinated maintenance work and so on. At the same time, with the same group, we did a project on using film as a research method to explore the infrastructural conditions in the town under this kind of refugee situation. And one film looked at the pollution of the Litani River and the impacts on local farmers. There's often a lot of blame on refugees because refugee camps are not connected to the sewage networks. A lot of the sewage goes into the local water bodies. And so there's this blaming of refugees for the pollution, which often is industrial. And another film researched waste sorting in the town. And it showed how Syrian refugee children, very young children from age 5 onward, were sort of involved in the recycling industry. And it also visited a waste sorting plant, which happened to be funded by Germany. And as this team went there, they noticed that nothing was happening. But when they came with a camera, people began turning on the machines. And so for the film, there was a certain performance of activity in this waste sorting plant. So this hints at the way that sort of global aid economies and infrastructural investments don't always reach residents because of corruption in Lebanon in particular, but also the global economies of waste. So, for example, Lebanon during the Civil War received a lot of toxic waste from countries, including Germany, where Western countries sort of use the political turmoil in one place to dump toxic nuclear waste in different places. So the citizen scientists sort of went into quite complex and difficult issues trying to uncover questions around pollution and corruption in the waste sector. So they took responsibility really for the town that they had just arrived in, some of them, and took on new roles in their communities as well. So they said, we became well known in the community. People would say, oh, let's go to the park, you know, that's your park. So they were associated with having sort of made improvements to the city and done this investigative work about the town as well. Several scholars, including Shannon Matern and Dev Chatra, talk about infrastructure as a form of care. And we know that refugees do a lot of care work in the private realm and in unrecognized ways in the public. But here, I think what was interesting is that these refugees didn't just demand, you know, or negotiate with the state, but they really stood in for the state and started sort of caring for the public realm and also had a kind of public visibility and recognition for taking responsibility in the public realm. The paper that I'm writing on this, I talk about feminist ethics of care. So John Tronto's work on feminist care ethics, where taking responsibility is a key part of caring, but also of democratic citizenship values. And so I think this kind of enactment and performance of responsibility in the public realm, and this recognition from others is a key element here, where care moves from the interpersonal and private into the public as an act of citizenship. The final little sketch is from London, where during the COVID lockdowns, I began doing research because I couldn't travel to my field sites anymore, and started doing work in front of my own door, which was became really interesting. You're probably familiar with the overall sort of narrative. Since Thatcher, there has been an extensive privatization of public services in the UK since 2010 with the Conservative government. And after the financial crisis, there's been a period of 14 years of austerity, of cutting public services. In particular, local authorities have seen around 60% of their of all their budgets cut, which has led to sort of them just doing the very minimum. And also since COVID, the war in Ukraine, Brexit, there's been a real cost of living crisis alongside inflation. And so food poverty has increased significantly across the UK. It affects different groups to varying degrees. So overall, around 18% of households are food insecure. But among ethnic minority households, that's around 30%. And with asylum seekers, that number is even higher. Around 80% of asylum seekers can't always access food when they need it. Increasingly, there's also work being done on the way that food is provided in asylum accommodation through kind of outsourced, privatized companies, of course. It's often so unhealthy and inedible that people get really ill, children are malnourished, and experts talk about it as part of the hostile environment for migrants. So it's a sort of an attempt to get people to not come. So, one respondent repeatedly received food that he was highly allergic to, and this was during lockdown. And asylum seekers in the UK, if they're in accommodation where food is provided, receive £8 per week to spend on transport or other things. £8 in London gets you one travel card for one day. And so on that money, he couldn't buy any other food. And this is how he ended up in this group that I'll talk about. There's a real reliance on the charity sector overall in the UK, increasingly for very basic provisions as well. But during COVID in particular, we saw that a lot of migrants, especially those that don't have a right to public funds, so that's people who are on temporary visas, as well as refused asylum seekers, they fall through the cracks even of the charity provision, because maybe you're the job center or your general practitioner will give you a referral to a food bank. And without that referral, you won't even have a right to go to a charity food bank. So there are people who weren't even being accepted by charities for food. And so during this time, a group was founded in East London that was called the National Food Service. This is part of a wider network of mutual aid groups across the UK. But in London, it was really these migrants without recourse to public funds and refugees, as well as long-term residents coming together to use surplus food to make culturally appropriate meals for those who are falling through the cracks of the public and the charity sectors. And what was really interesting to me and to my artist collaborator, Johan Arends, in this project was this idea of a national food service. So the name of the group is already modeled on the National Health Service. So the idea is to provide food as a universal basic service, so something that's free at the point of delivery, like a health service is in the UK. And through our work with them, we saw how they developed visions and proposals of what this kind of service could look like at a local scale. So how food could both address climate goals through using waste or food that would usually be wasted, but also how it could be culturally appropriate. And often that's intention because, say, certain Afro-Caribbean foods don't grow in the UK. You can't buy them locally. They have to be flown across the world. So how do you bridge that kind of difference? Also, we engaged in a participatory design process where people were working with small models to conceive of a space where people could have these free of charge community meals that they were envisioning. And the spatial infrastructure really played a key role. We also built it, then it became a mobile infrastructure that moved across different spaces. So churches, community halls, but also in this case, a community garden, and was jointly designed, jointly set up. And it played a key role in that it was the physical sort of table and chairs that these meals and discussions took place at, but also became a kind of platform, a kind of visual focal point for different groups to come together, to build solidarities, to talk about articulating different kinds of visions. And these collective visions about what food as a universal basic service could be were then also articulated to local authorities and so on. I conceptualize this kind of work as provisioning. So on the one hand, providing very basic services, feeding people for free, but also a kind of visioning, building community, prefigurative politics, if you will. So Rechstedt and Greiden define prefigurative politics as experimentally implementing the desired future social relations and practices in the here and now. So trying out the things that you're aiming for now and seeing how it works. These moments, yeah, were quite nice visions of how a free food service might work, and also things that wouldn't work. So it really goes beyond questions of maintenance and repair of existing systems, or of demanding, you know, more from the state in terms of bringing together skills, knowledge, aspirations for more just urban support systems that don't only serve refugees or migrants, but really could serve everyone better as well. Let me stop there with the case studies. I hope this wasn't too much, and try to reflect a little bit. I've tried to talk about this nexus between citizenship and infrastructure. So on the one hand here, we have the materiality of the infrastructures. And on the other hand, we have the kind of social side of how citizenship is articulated or built. So the material and spatial conditions of infrastructure might be, how many bins are there? How many food stores are there in your area? Or do you live in a food desert? The connections and disconnections, where can you tap into a system? Who is being served? Who's not being served? But also, you know, how often is waste collected? What are the conditions under which you receive the service? And then the way where I think infrastructure is really important in terms of infiltrating people's lived experience is these everyday rhythms, right? How do you cook? Where can you get together with others? How do you maintain hygiene in your home? These very basic things. How do you make sure you have enough food, water, power to go about your everyday? And that's a really, especially with food and waste, a really embodied process as well, where your senses are involved. If you're eating good food, if you're smelling waste, but also where you're really dependent on these services, sanitation, for your health and well-being. And if they're not there, your health is in danger. In addition, with both food and waste, there's a really sort of symbolic level and also affective elements that play in, where both food and waste can act as a boundary marker. So living in a neighborhood filled with waste sort of brings a lot of stigma with it. These ideas of objection, of disgust, of being expelled in some way when waste is not where it's supposed to be. Similarly with food, what I really saw was a lot of people coming to this food service when food is not appropriate, when food is not the kind of food that you think is good food, if it's off or if it doesn't correspond to your cultural needs, then there's often this really low threshold of disgust and of distancing yourself from other ways of eating. And that actually became a kind of a sticking point as well between the sort of volunteers who were often middle-class, young, queer, vegans, and the migrants who wanted to eat meat, for example, and didn't think that the food that they were being served there was real food. So there are these negotiations about what constitutes good food and where are you being supported properly. So here there's also this, all these questions of identity, sense of belonging in your relationship to these services. Do you just receive them passively? Or are you able to shape them as well? Overall, I think that results in shaping your capabilities, your life chances. If just getting the basic services is a struggle, if you spend time and energy on that, you don't have the capacity to care for your family, to get an education, to go to work, and so on, right? So that's the sort of horizontal axis. And then on the vertical level, I think about infrastructures as sites of negotiation between the state and the infrastructural subject as well, where from the top down, the state, I've talked about sort of bordering through connecting or disconnecting certain areas through its absence or withdrawal or the privatization of services, or setting conditions and shaping subjects through these kind of exchanges of rights and obligations that come through infrastructure. From the bottom up, the four types I've talked about are protests. So that could be demanding certain resources, but also refusing them if they don't suit your needs, adopting the conditions that you've been given, but also sometimes adapting different infrastructures to better suit your needs. So that's sort of a quiet means of protest sometimes. Then we've talked about maintenance and care, maintenance that takes place in the more invisible or private realm, and care that could take place in more public settings. And then this idea of provisioning and also prefiguring certain politics. To wrap up, I've tried to show across these different sites the importance of public services and enabling those excluded from national rights to enact urban citizenship. Non-citizens claim rights, but also enact responsibilities, I argue, through infrastructures, through this kind of repertoire of these four articulations of infrastructural citizenship I've mentioned here. So crucially, they're not just demanding services, but they also accept obligations and they volunteer to even take on responsibilities to demonstrate citizenship before they even get those formal rights. Infrastructures here become both an object and a means of these enactments of citizenship. It's worth saying that I've sort of chosen different exemplifications in each site, but actually each of these types exists in all of the sites. I think just to varying degrees. It's articulated differently in different locations depending on the prevailing citizenship regime and the infrastructural conditions there. So for example, in Lebanon, you have a place where there's insufficient infrastructural provision all across the country. At the same time, there's long-term exchange and historical links with Syria, where Syrians provide many services and maintain urban systems and actually even did before their displacement at the time, sort of as guest workers, if you will, or migrant workers. At the same time, Syrians are disconnected or were disconnected even a decade into their displacement from any national kind of networks. In contrast, in Germany, you have sort of near universal provision of infrastructural services. You have this kind of welfare citizenship, but at the same time, much more of a cultural difference, which then the state sought to bridge through infrastructures and the rights and obligations that come with them as well. And so I've tried to use this relational comparative approach to reveal some differences that allow us to kind of refine these concepts, but also show linkages. So, for example, around the global circulations of people and resources. The participatory design-based approach, I think, can be useful here to show how refugees actively shape cities and the contributions they can make for everyone's benefit. And here, the urban is not just an arena for realizing rights that you already hold on paper because you're already a citizen, but for kind of expanding the scope of citizenship through the spatial.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.